It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm sitting here in the studio wearing a pair of brown sneakers. And I was thinking back, why did I buy this particular pair of shoes? Well, to be perfectly honest, I think I chose them because I wanted to be nondescript. I didn't want anybody to pay attention to my shoes. But the truth is, whenever you walk into a room, people check out your shoes, and they figure out a lot about you by the shoes that you're wearing. And, you know, people have worn shoes from time immemorial. We have to protect our feet, and there are very few things that express as much about a person as the shoes they're wearing, and by extension, about culture of all of us and the place where we live, the environment where we live, and even how we relate to each other. And so I was excited to see that the Anchorage Museum is opening an exhibit, which will open this Friday, that is the day after tomorrow, for First Friday, called Footnotes, and it is focused just on shoes, the collection of shoes that are found in the museum, and what we can learn about them. And I've got two guests in the studio today to talk about the exhibit and talk about shoes, and we hope you'll join the conversation as well. Paula Rasmus Didi is with me. She's an artist, and she has work in the exhibit. Thanks for being with us, Paula.
Thank you.
And Carolyn Kozak is the museum, the exhibit curator from the Anchorage Museum. Carolyn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Carolyn, you have to tell me if shoes were a particular interest of yours. Are you like one of these shoe fanatics who loves to collect shoes and has a closet full of them?
Admittedly, I'm not. Actually, I have pretty big feet for a girl, so I have a hard time finding shoes, and I've always been more of a practical over fashionable, or well, functional over fashionable when it comes to my shoes, but I love looking at shoes, and I love seeing shoes, so the exhibit was just a great opportunity to learn a lot more.
Yeah, well, and these are shoes that kind of all have a message. I mean, that's sort of the idea behind it, isn't it, mm-hmm. that you're looking at shoes, and then you're interpreting them or reading them.
Sure. Well, the museum's collection is home to about 400 pairs of footwear from Alaska. So the exhibit pulls from that pool and kind of fleshes out the histories behind them. So we kind of we go topographically, roughly, and look at shoes that are used for industry or shoes that are used recreationally, shoes that are fashionable or children's shoes, kind of from there, and tell the personal stories behind them. Mm-hmm.
And there are some pieces there that are very old and that are from a time when people had to invest a significant amount of their resources into making shoes out or boots out of whatever there was in the environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I noticed, and we've got some of the images from the exhibit on our website. If you go to alaskapublic.org and go to Shoes of Alaska, you'll see some of these pictures. And one I'm looking at here looks like it's made out of fish.
It is. Those are fish skin boots. They're a pair of child's shoes. And fish skin is a pretty amazing material. It was, not only did salmon provide an enormous food source, but the skins were saved and smoked, and it actually creates a completely waterproof material. And Paula, you might be able to talk about some of this fancy stitch work that's done in shoes like this and materials, but special stitches were developed
right.
to make them waterproof.
Well, mm-hmm. and you have to do kind of a saddle or a whip stitch to make it waterproof because you have to have a ridge, just like you have a ridge in jeans.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that there's a ridge on the side of the jeans is to create that waterproofing, and that's called a whip stitch or a blanket stitch that's done on traditionally on those. And in my shoes, which are more I use traditional alley-oop beading techniques, but I use the traditional techniques in very contemporary, what I call mm-hmm. fantasy
yeah.
shoes.
And I want to get into that, but I want to just introduce folks so they know a little bit more about you. Paula Rasmus Didi is a noted artist, but you come from something of a traditional background in the materials.
Right.
You use. Tell us how you began with your
When I was a little girl, we were very poor, and my grandmother had one jar of what we called the Indian beads, and it was a little pickle jar, and she taught us traditional alley-oop bead weaving, and she would make us be very exacting in doing the beading, and I was probably beading by the time I was four or five. But then after we got the piece done, which were typically beaded bracelets, she'd have us cut the thread and put the beads back in the jar because we only had the one jar of beads. And so I beaded the entire time I was growing up and got to a place with a really good technique because she was very, very demanding about how we did things.
And it was a traditional Aleut way of doing it.
Traditional, mm-hmm. Yeah, peyote stitch, Navajo stitch, indibelly stitch, some of the common stitches. But no product survived from my childhood because we always had to cut the threads and put them back in the jars.
Because you didn't have enough money for more beads.
For more beads. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's nothing that survives that period. And I didn't touch a needle and thread or do any beading until many, many years later when I started working with Alaska Native groups in Alaska in employment and training programs and health programs. And in going out to the villages, it seemed to me that the fine bead weaving was disappearing. The technique wasn't as good and it wasn't as exacting as I was taught as a child. And so I stopped purchasing very much beadwork because the quality wasn't what I wanted. And so I started doing my own
work. Started doing your own and bringing back what you had been taught mm-hmm. when you were
a child.
Uh-huh. And we were talking a few days ago when I first contacted you about how you went from doing traditional designs to what we see now, which is in the exhibit, and there's a image of it at the top of our webpage of this crazy shoe
yep,
with the beads.
Not your mama's Mary Jane's.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, a super high platform shoe.
It's a stripper shoe.
Yeah, I'm gonna wait for you to say it.
It's a 6-inch stripper shoe, and I really like stripper shoes, and I really like pole dancing shoes, which mm-hmm. are even stranger looking than this one. And I like the architecture of shoes.
Yeah.
And so wherever I am in the world, I look for shoes that that at the minute I see them, the architecture of the shoe grabs me. Because uh-huh. I think shoes are truly fetish objects for people.
Mm-hmm.
And the more outrageous they are, the more exciting they are to me. Mm-hmm. And when I have shoes in exhibits, and I've had them all over the United States in exhibits, I'll sit off in a corner and watch, and people will come along and they'll either see my shoes and start laughing and pointing and really enjoying them, or they'll just stand there and shake their heads and frown. It's one or
yeah.
the other. There's sort of no medium ground. But
And they impact you directly because everyone has feet, everyone has shoes,
yeah.
and we all relate to each other's feet and shoes.
Right.
Even
and
if we don't
and
think
I try
it.
To make shoes, as outrageous as it looks, that can be worn.
Oh, really?
They have to be functional, so you could wear those shoes.
I'm thinking these pieces probably cost a little bit too much to wear.
That particular piece was earlier on, so those shoes were $2,000. My shoes, I have a pair of cowboy boots that are spectacular at the Alaskan Native Arts Foundation. They're called Pocahontas's Purple Ponderosa. And they're children's cowboy boots, and they're $10,000, and they're basically underpriced because mm-hmm. it took me 2 years to make them.
Yeah.
But they're more art pieces than functional pieces, but I try to make them functional.
I wouldn't let my kid wear them.
my granddaughters have worn the cowboy boots.
Oh, how neat. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. We are talking about shoes. There's a new exhibit going up Friday at the Anchorage Museum called Footnotes, which is all about shoes from the museum's collection. And I have two guests with me. You're just hearing from Paula Rasmus Didi, who's an artist whose work is in the show, and Carolyn Kozak is exhibit curator from the museum. And we'd love to hear from you. Questions for Paula or for Carolyn, or just your thoughts about shoes. You know, and I want to talk a little bit during the hour about some of the strange things that Alaskans have with shoes. We have some very special shoes in this state, and people use them to express themselves in strange ways. Not many people wear like fancy or expensive shoes, but we do wear our extra tufts, wear them many strange places. So if you would like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Outside of Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. Within Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. Have I got that right, Kristen? Yes. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. There is a pair of shoes in the exhibit, which is kind of an extra tough high heel, which is an amazing creation. But I'm seeing people wear extra toughs without having them be high heels in all kinds of situations where you would expect people to wear high heels. And I, you know, lived in coastal Alaska when I was younger, and people wore extra toughs because they were fishermen or because they're going to be down on the beach, or they might not wear them. Extra toughs are a little expensive for canneries. There'd also be cannery boots that people would wear. They're like more like $10, whereas extra toughs are like $70. Mm-hmm. And then you'd see, you know, sometimes you'd see girls wearing dresses and extra toughs, and that was sort of like a Homer look. But now I'm seeing them all over Anchorage. You even see people going out at night and dancing in them, which I think that's got to be the sweatiest thing in the world. Have you noticed that, Carolyn? These extra toughs everywhere?
I have. I have noticed that. Extra toughs and dance coats tend to be the two major shoes in Alaska. That I'm an outsider. I've actually been in Alaska for about 5 years now, and dance coats, I just couldn't believe it. They were everywhere.
I have about 25 pairs of dance coats. I love dance coats. I have hand-painted ones. Uh-huh. They're fabulous.
So they don't do that at other places?
I had seen them in, you know, if someone was a nurse or a doctor, it tended to be the footwear of choice, but I had never seen them on the streets in such high volume.
Just go to Skinny Raven and check out the dance coats.
They have amazing, and there's hand-painted ones in some of the galleries downtown. Uh-huh. Romney Dodd, I think, has painted dance coats that look amazing. Again, they seem too good to wear, but what do I know? I mean, I wear ratty old sneakers all day.
We did get Lisa Murkowski's dance goes for the show.
Oh, how great.
So,
are they special or?
They're what she wore throughout her historic writing campaign. So we were really excited to have them. And she actually sent us a pretty great video of a trip she took out to the Matsu Valley. And she got stuck in the mud in her dance goes, and it sucked the shoes right off of her feet. So
that's about U.S. senators from other states don't have to worry about some of these things. So the exhibit is not just artistic work like Paula does, but also some historic shoes. Any other historic shoes?
Yes. So in the museum's collection, we have some historic shoes. Like we have a pair from 1912 that belonged to Arne Erickson, who ended up being a longtime Anchorage resident, but they are Yupik-made thigh-high summer mukluks. They're waterproof. Wow. But he wore them on this long trek from Iditarod to Seward to catch the ferry out because his wife was ill in Seattle. But he was mining in Flat at the time when he received the word and kind of embarked on this 21-day trip, and he kept a journal along the way, so it's a very interesting read. But he wore those boots the whole way through November snow and slush.
Yeah, neat. So we've got a caller with this, Nicole from Eagle River. Nicole?
Yes. These aren't Alaskan shoes, but I lived in Japan for a while, and I lived in a small village there where my apartment didn't have a bath, and so I would go to the bathhouse down the street. And everybody in the village, and myself included, when we went there, we all wore these funny shoes called geta. And it kind of looks like you took a 2x4 and cut the length of your foot, and then cut two shorter lengths and stuck them on, kind of like stubby little stilts. And they were horribly uncomfortable, and it was next to impossible to find a women's size 10, but in Japan, but it's a fond memory of mine. It's a shoe. I've never seen anything like it here in America, but it's just a quirky little shoe. That's a huge part of life in Japan.
It's funny that different cultures have these sort of signature shoes. You know, you think of like the Scandinavian wooden shoes, or in Alaska Native culture. I guess we think of mukluks as
mukluks or moccasins, dance slippers.
And mukluks are typical. I mean, I think of sort of sealskin, but I don't know if that's really the traditional and typical.
Well, there's sealskin and ugric and moose skin. It depends on the region of the state that you're in, because they're going to use the materials that are naturally in that region of the state. So as you go from village to village, you're going to find the same type of footwear made out of whatever is local.
Nicole, did you actually buy a pair and try to wear it, or did you decide that that wasn't for you?
No, I bought a pair. Mine were men's, of course. I had to get a men's pair, and I did find was the biggest size in the men's section, and it's just, it's a really fond memory. They make this really loud clacking noise when you walk, and once you go to the bathhouse every day, it's a public bathhouse, and it's funny at night to see all the little mama sons and salarymen all clickety-clacketing their way to the public bathhouse, and it just became this ritual I really enjoyed when I lived there.
Do you still have them, Nicole?
That was my question.
Yes, I do. I still have my kita.
Fetish.
Yeah. Some things you can never let go of. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Nicole. You know, the comment you made, Paula, about, you know, the mukluks are made out of whatever's available,
mm-hmm.
calls to mind something I read that was written by one of the first outsiders to arrive on the North Slope. It was a military expedition, and that this writer was talking about how he'd talked to an elder and talked about all the technology that he as a Westerner had. And the elder said, well, you might think you're pretty good, but if I find myself out on the tundra and my mukluks wear out, I know how to kill a caribou and make this thread out of this sinew and use the
survive.
Skin. And I can make a pair of mukluks with just what I find out
mm-hmm.
there. Can you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, the traditional, the subsistence way of life is that, you know, to make everything. And now we live in a world where everything comes from somewhere else. We don't mm-hmm. really know how to make mm-hmm. our own shoes. Mm-hmm. I don't even suppose there's any shoe makers in Alaska.
Oh, I think there's some people that make shoes that you'll see at, like, in Homer at some of the festivals and things. There are a few cobblers in Alaska.
But, oh, really?
I think it's a dying art, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to appreciate anything that people put that much love and time into, you know, because like the shoes that I make, they could take a single shoe could take from a month to a year to make, depending on. So that goes beyond an item of apparel for wearing. It becomes an art form mm-hmm. unto itself. But the other part for me about the shoes that I make is they tell stories. They mean something to me. Not Your Mom is Mary Jane's. I made those because when I was a little girl, my grandmother made me wear orthopedic shoes, and I was always jealous of the little Catholic girls that went to the Catholic school that got to wear the pretty patent leather black Mary Janes, and I never had any. And so when I saw these at the Look, I said, those are my Mary Janes. And then when I was making them, I wanted to embellish them some more, and I remember that in high school, we were too poor for me to try out to be a cheerleader, and the cheerleader had pom-poms, and so the wire work on the shoe is the pom-pom for the cheerleader. So it's like kind of an ode to the things you didn't get to do in high school that you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole story that goes with them, and most of my pieces have stories that go with them, because when I see a shoe, it tells me a story,
mm-hmm.
and I immediately know what it's supposed to be.
Well, when I look at this, and I would really invite listeners who are not driving
mm-hmm.
and were at the computer or on their phone to check out this picture of the shoe that Paula created. Go to alaskapublic.org and click on Shoes of Alaska, and you'll see it right at the top. It's incredibly cheerful and joyous to me.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's an explosion of colors and beads and stripes and
wire work. And,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess as a form of expression, was that part of it too?
Yeah, I think it's kind of fun, and I also like doing stripper shoes because they're so architectural, because they have so much height to them, and they're not that long. And so you get, whenever I buy shoes, I buy the smallest pair they have available, because number one, it takes less beads to bead a smaller pair, but when you shrink the size of the foot, you get more architecture in the shoe, and I like that.
Mm. It's Hometown Alaska. The phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. What's your favorite pair of shoes? Would you like to share with the rest of us what is your favorite pair of shoes and what makes it your favorite pair? We'd love to hear from you. 550-8433. Now, I've asked that question, and I want to answer it for myself. And it's either going to be my extra tufts, which I wear all summer while I'm at my cabin, because they make me think of my cabin. Or it could be my money boots. which I got they're, you know, they don't make them like this anymore. So this is one of the things. It's like, it's very special for me because it's the old style bunny boots before they changed the manufacturing. If people don't know what bunny boots are, I think they were made for the Air Force.
Originally.
Yeah, they're super warm. I mean, you'll never be not warm enough in bunny boots. And they call them bunny boots because of these big white bulbous things with multiple levels of insulation. And my mom always told a story about first arriving in Alaska in 1966, seeing somebody wearing these things and thinking, oh, wow, what a terrible deformity. And then she saw somebody else wearing them and thinking, what's going on around here? And the third person, she started to figure it out. Do you have any bunny boots in the exhibit, Carolyn?
We do. Mm-hmm. We have kind of an earlier version of bunny boots. They aren't the air-inflated boots that you see commonly. They're the felted ones. And they come with a bunch of attachments for skis. So, you know, that you go from walking to strapping your skis on and you're on the go. Well, do you know the rest of the story about why they're called bunny boots,
no.
Charles?
No, let's hear it.
So, much like your mom, when members of the Air Force first came to Alaska during World War II, it was around World War II when the felted boots came out. They called them that because of the snowshoe hares in the fall would get their white boots. Their coats would start turning from brown to white, and they more and more hares would come out with their white boots on. And so when they were issued these boots, they called them bunny boots because they looked like bunny feet, you know, these white boots walking, stomping around.
And also, I always thought they were called that because they're so large. I mean,
Well, the black ones are also based, I think it was on Mickey Mouse.
They look like something olive oil would wear.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they do look crazy.
I'm trying to remember the nickname for the black ones that are similar, but I think they're Mickey boots.
Occasionally, you'll see somebody walking around in Anchorage and it's not that cold, and you think, oh, that poor person, his feet must be in a pool of sweat. And kind of it's the same thing with the extra tufts too. I've seen people actually dancing with them in nightclubs, and I think, okay, that's a fashion statement that's too high a price because they got to be so hot. But we've talked a little bit about how people are wearing them more. Mm-hmm. I guess it's an Alaskan statement because there's certainly nobody even knows what they are outside.
Well, boots are very fashionable right now, Charles. Okay. That's part of the problem. Well, not problem, but part of the trend, I guess. You know, you see a lot of knee-high boots, a lot of knee-high leather boots, and a lot of Alaskans have extra tufts. So.
And UGG boots are another thing that when I see kids spending the entire day wearing their UGG boots at school, I think, oh, wow, that's hot.
Well, I think it's a great example of the fact that what we wear in our feet is driven not only by the environment that we live in, but also by the society that we're in. So UGGs and extra tufts are fashionable.
And they're comfortable.
They're comfortable. So
comfort.
Again, they're practical. Everyone has them because it's wet up here or slushy or cold. But also, you know, the force of, and I don't want to call it peer pressure, but...
Well, I'll call it that because I think a lot of these a lot of these fashions start out with high school kids and young people. And if you really want to see inappropriate clothing, drive by a bus stop
for
middle school or high school, and you'll see on a 10 below zero day, there'll be a girl there in shorts and ballet slippers. And it's all that's important is the look. Nothing else matters.
Which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Especially I know. We make them tough in Alaska.
When you think of what an extreme environment we're in, I mean, the weather changes so quickly and... you know, a good pair of shoes really can save your life in this state, although, you know, not so much that we're industrialized in Anchorage. I don't feel like it's quite an issue.
But. Mm-hmm. Well, but though a lot of people are doing outdoor activities where they do need stuff.
Right.
So how did these particular pieces of footwear get into the collection? Were they donations from people who have something special? Because it seems to me that, you know, if you think about historic sort of footwear, unless some so special circumstances, probably would get worn out before it's historic.
Right, which is an issue for collectors in particular. Mm-hmm. It's a wide range. We have some that were donated by the museum, like the Huffman Collection is, I think, one of the largest group of Alaska Native objects that's ever been donated to the museum. There's... also, items that we purchased, like Paula's piece. You know, there's things that have been donated from old Anchorage families. We have a great pair of skis from the Seberg family, the Lindsay Seberg family that lived in Anchorage around the turn of the 20th century. And the story has it that these wooden skis helped the family leave the house after kind of a historic snowfall blocked their first floor entrance. So they climbed out the second story window and skied down a snowdrift.
Uh-huh.
Kind of fun stories like that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So do you have other, like a whole collection of clothing or more shoes than anything else?
We do have a lot of clothing in the collection. There's a lot of historic clothing, coats, parkas, some really beautiful bird pelt parkas.
Mm-hmm. So it must be a challenge deciding what you're gonna exhibit.
It is. And you know, this footwear collection was spurred on by a grant and aid that we received from the Alaska State Museums. Our collections manager, Darian Latoka, worked with Merrill Janicki, an intern, to rehouse the entire footwear collection, which is over 400 pairs. So it's a huge job, and the storage conditions were improved immensely. And during that time, it also allowed us to catalog that particular collection, photograph it, so we knew what we had, and suddenly we started finding these stories, and this information was made available to us for an exhibit, and it fit perfectly into our atrium exhibit calendar, and we're really excited for the opening on Friday.
So the opening is part of First Friday, and so there's a free period when folks can come in and don't have to pay to visit the museum, right?
Yes, after 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Friday evening, you can wander around downtown, look at the exhibits, get to the museum at 6 o'clock, get your free ticket, mm-hmm. and it's how the exhibit is housed in the atrium?
It is. It's on the second floor of the atrium. On the first floor will be the Watercolor Society's show, also opening on Friday, and the second floor will be Footnotes.
You know, it seems to me that the objects of clothing and footwear probably don't mean that much unless the story is associated with it. Is that true, or do you get a message from these objects without the story that's attached to it?
Well, I think footwear is very similar, like Paula was saying, how it's fetishized, but as a museum employee, I think most historic objects, a lot of people have that sort of reaction to them. There's this idea that something is old and has been in places and seen things that have long gone and experienced mm-hmm. things that, you know, a way of life that doesn't really exist anymore. So I think the shoes do stand alone. They do speak for themselves as objects. The stories just make them that much more significant and personal. You know, when you have...
I think the other thing about if people come in and they look at a shoe, they may have had that shoe mm-hmm. or they may have had that shoe at their high school dance, or the class clown wore that shoe in a play. You see objects like in secondhand stores or something, and they bring back a moment in time to you. And so you create your own story with the object, whether it's a shoe or a teapot. I mean, mm-hmm.
it's the personal aspect of
yeah,
it, which is
what,
part of your art, isn't it?
Print on it, mm-hmm. yeah.
Is that part of what makes it a good canvas for you to do your work, because it's this universal and very personal thing?
Well, really, yeah. Like, I'll see lots of couples come up and look at my shoes, and the woman's just over the moon about the shoe, and the guy's just, like, standing there like
whatever.
Can we move on to the next thing now? So it's a different visceral reaction that people have, but women in shoes, I watch a lot of HGTV because I'm retired now, and I sit and watch TV and bead, and I'd say about a third of the time when people are shopping for houses, one of the requirements of either the husband or the wife is there isn't enough shoe storage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that says a lot about the American society
yeah.
because people really love their shoes.
And how many can you really wear?
but lots of people have several hundred pairs of shoes. Lots mm-hmm. of people that you know have several hundred pairs of shoes. They're just not talking about.
I think people enjoy buying shoes.
Yes, yes.
There's the pleasure of simply shopping yeah. for and buying shoes.
Right.
Which seems to be lean more towards the female gender. I mean,
I think so, but there's a lot of guys with athletic shoes that mm-hmm. have pairs and pairs of athletic shoes. And, you know, my husband always teases me and says, how many pairs of shoes can you wear at one time? Well, it's not about the wearing. It's about the having, you know.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, men don't have as many choices, right? I mean, you could go out and buy every style of shoes there are, and you mm-hmm. still wouldn't be up to Imelda Marcos. So, and for those young people out there, well, you'll just have to ask somebody what I'm talking about when I say Imelda Marcos. Well, this is a great topic, and I would love to invite listeners to share your thoughts about shoes, your favorite shoes. What's the essential Alaskan shoe? Do we have it covered with extra tofts and mukluks, or do you think there are other shoes that are particularly Alaskan?
Sorrels.
Sorrels could be on the list. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we mm-hmm. could have a vote. Anyway, we're having a discussion here with Carolyn Kozak, who is the curator of the exhibit that's opening at the Anchorage Museum on Friday, Paula Rasmus Didi, who is an artist who creates amazing beaded shoes. The show, I'm Charles Woolforth. We're going to be back, and I'll give you those phone numbers to call in right after this break.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we are talking about shoes. There's an exhibit opening at the Anchorage Museum on Friday on this subject, and it's a great way to look at, well, what does it mean to be Alaskan, and why do we choose the shoes we choose? Boy, that's kind of a tongue twister. We'd love to hear from you. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Email works as well. I can read your message on the air, and if you have a question for our guests, share it with them. Send your email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And my guests are Carolyn Kozak, who's the exhibit curator for the Footnotes exhibit that's opening on Friday, and Paula Rasmus Didi, who's an artist who creates amazing shoes, and her work is in the exhibit. Paula, you were saying that there's very few artists doing, native artists doing shoes.
Beaded shoes?
This is something you've almost got to yourself.
Well, in Alaska, I've got it pretty much to myself. There's two other noted artists from the Southwest that do what I call lazy stitch, beaded high top tennis shoes. And lazy stitch is you pick up 7 beads at once and do 7 beads at a time. So it's a much faster way of beading. Mm. Peyote stitch, which is the stitch that I do, you pick up 1 bead at a time and you go through the bead 4 times.
Oh my
so
gosh.
It's much more labor intensive. But the other two artists, and I'm sorry I can't remember their names right now because I'm on medication for an accident, but when we were at the Changing Hands exhibit, which was an exhibit of the top native artists in the United States some years ago.
Mary Jane's traveled in that.
Yeah.
Show.
Okay. Yeah. They both came up to me and said, why are you doing peyote stitch on shoes? That's got to take so long. And I said, because I like the way it looks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the product more than I like the lazy stitch look. It's a different, I can do lazy stitch and I could be a lot more productive if I did lazy stitch, but I wouldn't like it.
And what made you decide to move away from traditional?
This is another one of those sort of vision quest things.
Uh-huh.
Many years ago, I was one of the people that decided that for the Alaska Women's Resource Center, we needed to do a juried bead show as a fundraiser. And so we did the first Artie Gras, and it was at the Egan Center. And they asked all this sort of noted Alaskan bead artists to enter pieces. And so we all did, and there was Penny Zobel and myself and different people. And we all entered pieces that were jewelry, and they all looked basically the same. They were different colorways and different sizes of beads, but the techniques were basically the same, and the pieces were basically the same. And I was bothered by that. And that night I went home, and it was a two-day show, and I couldn't sleep. And I was up all night, and I was like pacing up and down. What could I do? What could I do that would be different? And for some reason, this light bulb went off in my head. And from the 1970s, I had a pair of Ferragamo pumps that were my party shoes that I hadn't thrown out. And they were in the back of the closet, and I dug them out, and I started trying to bead them in the middle of the night. And my husband got up in the morning and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm trying to figure out how to bead these shoes." And he said, "You're crazy. People are buying up your jewelry in scads. Why would you waste your time doing shoes?" And my neighbor, Andy Kirsch, was an artist and a metal worker, and he came down to the house, and I was working on these shoes, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm trying to figure out how to bead these shoes." And he said, "I'll buy them from you for $1,000. So I looked at my husband and said, "See, I'm not the only one that
right,
likes beaded shoes."
You're not crazy after all. Yeah.
And it took me a year to do that first pair of shoes. And if I looked at them now, I'd probably cry because they'd be so horrible. But
for $1,000 a year is actually not that good pay.
No, it's not good money at all. But I proved that I could do it.
Uh-huh. And now your work is obviously highly admired. We've got a caller, Caroline, calling from Anchorage. Caroline?
Yes, hi. And Paula's description of why she did something because she wanted to and she wanted a challenge is the definition of a great artist.
It's true.
So my reason for calling is I had the pleasure many years ago of getting to travel to rural Alaska, and based upon a program that I was involved in, I was given a pair of muckluks by the Reindeer Herders Association. And I was out in Unalakleet with a friend. We had this, the company I worked for had these clinics that we took to different communities throughout Alaska. And this lady was not involved in the clinic part, but she had always wanted to go to St. Lawrence Island. And she was from Unalakleet. And so anyway, I was able to finagle a way for her to go out there with this project. And we stopped off in Unalakleet. And her mother, Elizabeth Sarin, saw me clomping around in my mucklucks because I had about three pair of socks on. And she said, "Oh, no, let me get you something." And she came back with what she called Eskimo socks. Now, these were the little squirrels that are out there, ground-type mammals. And she said that she went through about six pair a winter. What they did was to barely take all the meat off the hide, and then they loosely stitched them so you could fit your foot in. And, of course, the fur was to your foot, and the hide was to the hide inside the muckluck. And, you know, I went from clobbing around to feeling like I was going to be able to take flight. The difference was amazing. And I got to Fairbanks in 67 when minus 40 and 50 was kind of like the norm. And I have never had my feet as warm as they were in those little rabbity-like, you could do it with rabbit fur too, but with those Eskimo socks, it was just astounding, that fur on your foot. And
that's a treasure. Do you still have them?
No, they don't last very long. If I lived in that environment, you bet. Forget these thermal socks. Man, I'd be out there chasing down those little critters.
Yeah, it's true. You know, the beaver hats are really the warmest hats you can wear in the Arctic as well. That nobody's ever figured out really a warmer hat. And the folks who do, you know, snow machine treks across the Arctic, they know to get beaver hats. Some of the old things work best.
Well, not only that, but you look at how long the folks have been there, for crying out loud. You know, we should take more clues from them.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this program.
Thanks for calling, Caroline. So, Caroline, do you have some items in the exhibit that are like very warm Arctic traditional items?
We do. We actually have two types of socks. One is the grass-woven socks that are common to Yupik and Inupiaq cultures, and they work on multiple levels. Not only are they an insulating layer, but they also wick moisture away naturally because it is a grass. And oftentimes, grass is stuffed in between the sock and the sole of the shoe as an added dry barrier, a little warm space.
It seems like that would be, I mean, is it like a very loosely woven so you can get it on and off, or how does that work?
It looks like a grass boot or booty almost. So it is pretty tightly woven, not as fine or as tight as a basket per se, but a similar idea. And we also have socks made out of loon pelts. So you can imagine how thick those would be.
Did you get any items out of the Smithsonian Northern Studies Center collection? Do they have footwear as well?
They do have footwear in that collection, and it's still on view in the Arctic Studies Center, so you can see it there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's the most unusual or most expensive item that you've got? I mean, there must be some really weird stuff.
There's some weird stuff. Well, if we want to just talk weird, okay. I am not really sure what something is worth. As far as I'm concerned, everything in the museum's collection is priceless. So,
right. Okay.
But I think the high-heeled extra tufts are definitely, as far as strange goes, that's pretty high up there.
And how did that come to be?
So those belong to a woman named Brandy Prefontaine. She's from Southeast Alaska. She had them custom made for her by Honeywell when she was the Alaska candidate for the Mrs. USA competition.
Is Honeywell the company that makes the extra tufts?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
So
those really are one in a million.
They really are. And I'm not sure if you can see them in the photo, but they actually have gemstones on them.
Oh, my
gosh.
Have
little rhinestones along the cuff.
Yeah,
and
folks, you can see these at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show, and there's a picture of them right there on the page.
So Brandy grew up living a nearly subsistence lifestyle, and her and her husband continue to live that way now. And so the boots were kind of her connection to where she's from, but also, to femininity. And I think they're really great. They kind of blur that fashion versus functional line.
And, mm-hmm. I've often wondered if the Extra Tough company knows how their shoes are being used, and that they've got this huge...
Do they want to know?
Do they want to know, right. But, lots of people cut them off and make them into sort of sneakers after they're mm-hmm. no longer waterproof.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty great. And, that design, the Extra Tough design, has been around much longer than you would think. The summer mukluks that the Inupiaq and Yupik people made, they're in concept and design, they're virtually identical. Mm-hmm. So Extra Toughs are used by fishermen because they're easy to walk in, because they're tight in the ankles and mm-hmm. Up the calf, and also because they have great treads on the bottom.
And the tread will also bends with your foot, so the cheap Kenry boots are much stiffer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the extra toughs are really that tough. I think the Kenry boots actually last longer, mm-hmm. but they really take it out of your foot, whereas the extra toughs feel good, basically.
But the original extra toughs, as I like to call them, were made out of seal skin, so the fur would be scraped from the hide, and it would go through a tanning and curing process. And actually, the two-tone color that is so familiar to extra toughs, that dark brown and kind of the tan,
mm-hmm.
these hide mukluks have the same coloration, and they actually have ties around the ankle to make them easy to walk in, and they're waterproof.
Hmm.
So if you come to the exhibit, you'll get to see a pair of rubber extra tufts in a case full of these summer mukluks. It's pretty fun to see them all together.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that Native people, pre-contact people, must have spent an awful lot of their time making shoes. I mean, when we think of, how long does it take me to earn the money to buy a pair of shoes?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Less than a day, certainly, a few hours at the most. But if I have to make a pair, that would be a huge investment, and they also wouldn't last that long, I would think.
Well, some of the shoes you can actually
see. They don't have rubber. They have...
Right.
Yeah.
But you can see where repairs were made to mm-hmm. the boots. These intricate little patches and beautiful stitch work around the hole. And, I think there was a much greater effort to repair something that you already had as opposed to making a new pair.
Throwing them away, mm-hmm. right.
But the fish skin boots, those little booties there, this what you were saying about them falling apart, moms used to tell their children, don't step in dog poop when you're in your summer fish skin boots. And it wasn't just because they were worried about the mess. It's actually because dog feces has enzymes in it that will break down the collagen that makes fish skin waterproof. So they'd come home and they'd have holes in their boots because the wear would happen that quickly.
I would think that it's surprising that a fish skin boot would even work, because I wouldn't think that the skin would be strong enough or pliable enough, to really stand up to the use of a shoe.
Well, the people who work with fish skin, and it is coming back. There are mm-hmm. artists. There was a large fish skin workshop at through the Arctic Studies Center just a couple months ago. But it's a process to prepare the fish skin. There's cleaning and scraping and smoking, and it's the glycoprotein in the fish skin forms a super tight net of collagen after it's been smoked and cured, and so it's really strong, and it actually is soft to work with after that, and easy to sew.
Mm-hmm. Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm with Carolyn Kozak, who you were just hearing from, who's the exhibit curator for the exhibit that's opening at the Anchorage Museum on Friday, called Footnotes, which is all about Alaskan shoes. And it's shoes from elsewhere or just Alaska?
Alaska and the circumpolar north. We have some Siberian or even cultured shoes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Paula Rasmus Didi is with me, too. She's an artist whose work is in the exhibit, and she works in shoes and other things. Are you pretty much just doing shoes?
No, I do other things. I make jewelry, but I've beaded hubcaps, telephones, toys. I did a whole tricycle that was on display at the Anchorage Museum, and that now resides at the Heard Museum in Phoenix.
Is that right?
In their permanent collection.
So you must have had to figure out how to bead these things. No one's ever beaded these things before. Is it kind of challenging to get the beads to stay on there, or how do you even do
it? Well, I use double-sided tape. Sometimes I use glue, but I don't like to use glue because it discolors glass beads, especially if they're silver or gold filled beads. That distorts the metal in mm-hmm. the beads. So normally I either friction fit them if it's like circular peyote around tubing in a bicycle. You can friction fit that, so it's just
get it tight enough that it doesn't
get
move.
It tight enough and you weave it on. The hardest part about doing the tricycle was that I couldn't take it apart, so I had to hold it in my lap at various angles and bead it, so it was somewhat awkward. But I know a lot of it, my husband says, I'm always challenging myself to go beyond what the physics of the situation will allow. And I have lots of half-completed projects that didn't work out.
The physics won.
but when the physics works, and I can, like, I have a piece that was in an earlier museum show that a private collector here in Anchorage has, that's a metal extruded shoe, and then has a freeform butterfly with arched wings that hangs off the side of the shoe. And the question was how to arch the wings and get the beads to be static without putting wire or anything in the wings. And it took me a long time to figure out how to do that, but I did it. So I was really pleased with that. And I did it with floor wax.
Oh, really?
Molding it over a glass
and
getting enough floor wax on it. But it can't sit in the sun.
Right. So where does the vision come to you for these pieces? How do you decide that this is the object that I want to bead, and how you want to bead it?
Well, if I go to a shoe store and I walk in the shoe store, I look for the most outrageous shoe that I can find, and I start with that. And then I'll look at it, and I'll set it on a plain white background sheet of paper if I don't immediately know, but I usually immediately know. My favorite shoe store in the whole world is a place called Freak's Lounge in Soho, and it's a transvestite shoe store.
Uh-huh.
And they know me there because I go there and I'm not one of their normal customers.
Right.
And I go in and I say, I want to see the strangest shoes you have. And they bring out these shoes that are just ridiculous. And the best pair of shoes I got there was a pair of 8-inch platform heels. And the same collector that has the butterfly shoe here in Anchorage has the 8-inch platform shoes. I gave them to her and her husband for their wedding. They're just freakish. They're just, they're just crazy shoes. You look at them and go, if you fell off that shoe, you'd break your ankle for sure, because they're so ridiculous. But they're so ridiculous that they make you smile. Mm-hmm. We all need to smile more. So
that's part of the point of it, is just the pleasure.
And there's nothing better than going to the Freak's Lounge and coming out with like 15 pairs of shoes and having all these men look at you like, what is she doing here buying shoes? It's just too much fun.
Uh-huh.
Paula, it sounds like your artwork is a lot about the process as well. It sounds like a labor of love.
Oh, it is absolutely a labor of love. And, it takes me so long to make a pair, and My husband's my biggest critic on the shoes because I'll think that I'm done. So I'll finish it and I'll say, okay, I think I'm done. And he'll go, it's not you enough. It's not over the top enough. Keep going. Uh-huh. And then at some point you have to stop because you can only get so much stuff on one shoe. You know?
That's right. I mean,
the cowboy boots that are at the Anchorage Arts Foundation probably have 100,000 beads on them.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and that's one bead at a time four times, you know. So, yeah, it's a labor of love. It's a labor of love to sit down with a boot and say, okay, I'm going to commit to you for the next year and you're going to go everywhere that I go.
Uh-huh.
Because that's basically what happens, you know, and it becomes kind of like an appendage. And, but most of the time when I see an object, I immediately see the object and know what it's going to become.
Mm-hmm.
And the finished object, depending on whether or not I can find the materials that I want, won't be far off from what I envision it at the beginning.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we are talking about shoes because of a new exhibit that's starting Friday at the Anchorage Museum. And we have a time left for some callers who might have their own thoughts about shoes. What is the essential Alaskan shoe, or what's your favorite shoe, or what's the strangest shoe in your collection? The number here is 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, email hometown@alaskapublic.org. Paula was talking about this transvestite shoe store in New York City.
The Freak's Lounge.
Yeah, we don't have any stores like that here in Anchorage.
We have the look. I love the look.
But, I mean, the fact is that if you were to walk through the street in Manhattan and check out people's shoes and then walk through the street in Anchorage and check out people's shoes, you'd be pretty disappointed in Anchorage because here most people are just wearing sneakers all the time, right?
Well, what I think is great about Anchorage is you have such a wide range of the types of shoes you'll see. So you will see some, you know, if you are near Nordstrom's or in the shopping areas, you might see some snazzy high-heeled shoes, mm-hmm. or some boots, some leather boots. But, you know, it really runs the gamut. I mean, you have people in their muddy fishing boots. You have people in their hiking boots or their tennis shoes or, you know, every color of Dansko imaginable. And flip-flops. I mean,
but what I love about shoes in Anchorage is the acceptance level.
Because mm-hmm.
you can go to Orso. I went to Orso for dinner last week, and there was a lady in there in duck boots.
Uh-huh.
And she was treated just as well as, you know, this woman next to her in Ferragamo.
It's a classless society.
Yeah.
And the same thing at the Performing Arts Center. You can be at the biggest sort of black tie affair, and there will be people there in flip-flops and Carhartts and all these other things.
Yeah, it's an inclusive society, I think, in that way, and that's exciting.
Did you include any of those totally non-special shoes, like just sneakers or something in your exhibit, or did you just sort of stick with the things that are more exciting and exceptional?
We have work boots and shoes. The one sneaker we have does have a rather unique story behind it.
Yeah, what's that? The Binky shoe.
Yes, we have the Binky
you
shoe.
Oh, the Binky shoe. That's an Alaskan shoe.
Yeah,
for sure.
And you know, that's been a long time ago now, so we need to tell the people the story.
Caroline? So, Binky was a polar bear.
Beloved polar bear.
Yeah.
Yes. At the Alaska Zoo, who became infamous after having a run-in with an Australian tourist who got too close to his enclosure.
And what was this woman doing? She actually climbed in or climbed. There was a barrier that she went over.
She climbed over it.
Two barriers.
And she wanted to get a picture.
She wanted to get a closer photograph,
mm-hmm.
yes. And he actually grabbed
her. Was Binky a he or a she?
He. Binky is a he. Yes. Binky grabbed her through the bars, and she did suffer a broken leg and some bite wounds.
And it's a red high-top tennis shoe,
and extreme,
right?
Also suffered extreme public humiliation.
Yes. Yes. But he got her shoe from her, and he actually carried it around like a little trophy.
Wouldn't give it back.
Yeah, nearly, I think it was almost a week or
before
the zookeepers could retrieve it. So he was almost like a dog with a prized toy.
Almost seems like, you know, if watching all those yummy people go by, you finally get a piece of one, you ought to be able to keep it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and really what I found so interesting about the story was the outpour of support for Binky afterwards from Alaskans saying, you know, this enormous predator should be respected for what he is, and you know, it's not Binky's fault.
The tourist definitely got the worst end of that. The public opinion on that.
There were T-shirts made. Mm-hmm. I found charms from charm bracelets.
Posters,
of Binky,
yeah.
with with a tennis shoe in his mouth.
So who saved the shoe? Was it given to the museum right away? Or?
No, it wasn't. It's actually not part of our collection. I kind of had this idea of including the shoe in the show, and I called up Patrick Lampe, who's the director at the Alaska Zoo, and left him an embarrassed voicemail asking him this distasteful question if he still had the tennis shoe. And he called back and said, we still have it. No one knew what to do with it, so we just stuck it in a cabinet.
And that's fabulous.
Yeah.
That's where it's at. So
I think they should donate it to the museum. Jeanette is with us from Anchorage. Jeanette?
Hi. Yes. I just wanted to tell a story. When I was traveling in Jamaica, my sandals broke. So, you know, there's all kind of street vendors and you name it. So I just went in and picked out a pair of sandals. And, you know, they felt comfortable and everything. And a few days later, it started raining. And in between the sole and the top of the shoe was cardboard. It was like recycling, sort of at its best.
Went back to nature,
or
huh?
Or worse.
Yeah, I guess we've all bought shoes that we wished we hadn't bought.
Yeah, but I love the design of the beads on the native shoe. It's just remarkable what they do.
Yes, yes. Thank you for calling. And we don't have much time left, but... Paula, are there different cultures within Alaska that have different traditions in terms of beading shoes? Athabascans seem like they do a lot.
Athabascans bead a lot of slippers and down slippers. Mukluks have beading on them, but they're larger. They're usually pony beads, the larger beads.
Mm-hmm.
The really fine, I think the finest beading on the footwear in Alaska would be the Athabascan beading mainly. Aleut beadwork is more on the dance gloves and things like that now than on the footwear.
Would they have used this kind of decoration just for everyday items, Carolyn, or is it just sort of for special things?
They're usually for ceremonial mm-hmm. use and celebration.
Yeah.
See, the way I look at the beading that I do is if I'm doing beadwork, if it wouldn't be good enough to hand down in my family, then I shouldn't be doing it.
It's too much trouble, yeah.
Right, and so there's, in any Native American artwork that you're going to see, there's going to be tourist work,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be traditional work, and the traditional work is usually kept pretty much within the culture,
mm-hmm.
and that's the kind of work that museums want, because
yeah.
it's like
real.
I said, it's real, and it's the craftsmanship that isn't put into the, let's make it and sell it.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much to both of you. Carolyn Kozak, curator of the new exhibit, Footnotes at the Anchorage Museum. Thanks for being with us. And Paula Rasmus Didi, who's an artist whose work is in the exhibit. The exhibit opens Friday. The free time is 6 o'clock if you want to check it out. I'll be back to host Hometown Alaska next week when the topic will be the Matsu Ferry, the ferry that's been built for quite an expensive price but can't be used, and figuring out what to do with it next. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.